from Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the completely soundproof Argo Studios in this loud New York City. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we're very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Happy New Year! May 2015 bring you and our world a renewed sense of hope and possibility as we rise to the challenges that we can overcome only together. And we do look forward together. I do want to look back for a few minutes. Over the 16 years that I was privileged to serve as president of Interfaith Alliance, a position from which I've now retired, as well as over the past year of State of Belief Radio, a program that needs to continue for so many reasons, I can't count them all.
Take a very, very touchy question, role of women in the church, or what to do with homosexuals. This Pope has a completely different attitude as compared with the immediate predecessor.
But since declaring itself a caliphate in June, ISIL has gained significant territory.
It's an excuse to discriminate against Christians. That's all it is, and it's stupid.
We voted against this resolution not because we are indifferent to the daily hardships or the security threats endured by Palestinians and Israelis, but because we know that those hardships will not cease until the parties reach a comprehensive settlement achieved through negotiations.
I think it remains very hard for Christians to say this simple thing. We were wrong. We've been wrong on slavery, on race, on women, on a whole host of issues.
All too often, today's news cycle obsesses with a current story to the exclusion of all others, and then quickly moves on to the next headline, with no time to digest events nor to integrate them into a broader understanding of the world we live in. To a degree, the same thing happens in news related to religion. So it's important that we take a look back on the news highlights of the past year when we have the chance to do that. And it's become a tradition to do that around the first of the year with Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom. And, as always, it's great to welcome Kevin back, not only at the beginning of the year, but to have him around anytime. We love having him on State of Belief Radio, and he is our first guest of 2015. Kevin, welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Walton.
Oh, well, so what would be the defining religion news stories of 2014 as reported by Religion News Service?
Well, you know, this year was kind of hard to pick sort of a newsmaker or a top story because there were so many to choose from. But I think, you know, if you take the 30,000-foot view, I think the rise of the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or whatever we're calling it these days, it was probably the biggest story of the year, both in terms of, you know, the real-life threat that it poses to Americans, but especially to people living in Iraq and Syria, the political questions that it raises. But also, I think that one of the biggest stories is the challenge that it poses to Muslims and to Islam, for mainstream Muslims to differentiate themselves from ISIS and its brutality and to say, this is not us, this is not the Islam that we believe in or that we practice. And so, you know, there's a real struggle. It has been for a couple of years, but ISIS really highlighted the struggle for the heart and soul of Islam. Mm-hmm. And this year we saw, or in 2014, we saw, you know, this new ugly, horrible, menacing face come to the surface, and a lot of people still trying to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. Kevin, is that the story, or is there another that you would say defines religion news in the past year?
There's so many times when I think that we could rename ourselves the Pope Francis News Service because we write about the guy so much. And, you know, he had a pretty spectacular year on all fronts. You know, he convened the synod at the Vatican to discuss family life and issues of contraception and divorce and cohabitation and gays and lesbians and all the rest. And you know, that was a topsy-turvy, headline-grabbing affair, and it was, you know, really meaty, and there was a lot there, and, you know, the kind of discussion that people have never seen at the Vatican before. And so, you know, we thought, okay, well, that's probably, you know, the biggest Francis story of the year. And then the man goes and finds a way to reestablish diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba at the end of the year. So, you know, somebody, a friend of mine, said, never write your year-in-review story so early in December, because Pope Francis always has something up his sleeve.
Well, I think the question that brings to my mind is the Pope just getting started?
Well, it certainly seems that way. And, you know, he turned 78 in the middle of December, and, you know, a lot of people – I was thinking about this the other day. When he was elected, a lot of people looked at him and said, you know, there's this guy, nobody's ever really heard of him before, really, and he's 76, and, you know, obviously this is a short-term caretaker pope, you know, probably not going to be super significant, and I would argue that he's, you know, one of the most consequential popes that we've had, not only for what he's doing, but how he's changing the tone, and how he's changing, you know, the role of the Catholic Church on the world stage, as we saw in the Cuba situation. You know, he's opened up a new definition of what it means to be a religious leader and the types of people that he wants around him. So, you know, remember 2014 was also the year of Bishop Bling, you know, the German bishop who spent $43 million on his house and got fired by Francis. So in all sorts of ways, you know, he's really shaking things up and turning everything upside down. And it's not just for the Catholic Church, and I think that's partly what's so interesting about him.
Kevin, I don't want to just pitch our tent right here because there's a lot more to talk about. But I do want to ask you, I've been listening over the last several days to people talk about the integral role that the Pope played in negotiating this change in our relationship with Cuba. Is that what a Pope ought to be doing? I think that's what a lot of people are saying. And a lot of people who question Obama are this time questioning whether or not two political leaders should be listening that carefully to the Pope.
Well, you know, this sort of echoes back to the 1960 campaign when everybody thought that John F. Kennedy as the first Catholic president would be taking orders from Rome, and obviously that wasn't the case. But, you know, I think that the Pope, but more broadly the Catholic Church, really does have a role to play on the world stage, and I think the Cuba story really illustrated the potential for the church in good ways. You know, the church acted here as basically an honest broker and provided a safe space for both sides to come together and work out their differences. And both sides could look to the church to say, okay, you know, if the church believes that Cuba is legitimate, then the U.S. can believe that, and vice versa, that Cuba could believe what the Americans were saying because the church was backing it up. So there is, I think, a role for honest brokers within religion. I don't think we have enough of those, honestly. And, you know, whether or not this pope or this particular church is the right way to do it, you know, I guess you could argue about that. But, you know, a lot of times the church, or any church, is the only body that's talking to our enemies when we're not. And so it is I think, an important back channel not to forget. And I think we have sort of forgotten about that in recent years and showed us kind of what the potential is.
That's a great point. Well, another issue. What about the moves toward inclusion of LGBT persons in both some mainline denominations and among young evangelicals?
Yeah, so this was, you know, kind of a banner year for, I guess you would say homosexuality, but specifically gay marriage. In 2014, the number of states that allowed gay marriage doubled from 17 to 35, plus Washington, D.C. And, you know, it used to be that I could count on one hand the number of states that allowed gay marriage, and now I actually have to go look at the map to see who doesn't, which is remarkable. You know, kind of like lifting the Cuba embargo. Like, I never thought I would see that in my lifetime, and here it is right in front of us. So, you know, big, big progress on the civil front. And, you know, some important shifts and changes on the church side of things. You know, the Presbyterians voted to allow openly gay pastors with mm-hmm. barely a shrug, which is different from, you know, previous debates on that. In the Methodist Church, which is, you know, a mainline church, a lot of people think of it as fairly liberal, but it's actually, among the mainline churches, it's probably the most conservative, mm-hmm. especially on this issue of human sexuality. And what they saw was a slew of pastors, you know, dozens of pastors who were brought up on charges of breaking church law for marrying gay couples civilly. And for the most part, they were all vindicated in one way or another. Some of them were, they got their sentences dropped. Others were, they were defrocked for doing this, and then they were refrocked and reinstated to the clergy. Mm-hmm. And so you saw a really interesting shift there away from kind of a disciplinary process to try to handle this. All segments of the church are tired about fighting about this, and so they're trying to figure out how do we do this and still live together in such a way where we're not going to end up killing each other over it. But, you know, also within the Catholic Church, you saw some shifts. You know, a story that got very little attention at the very end of the year, but kind of important. The U.S. Catholic Bishop's point man on gay marriage, you know, the guy who is tasked with resisting it at all costs, sat down very, very quietly with two leading gay Catholic groups, including this group called New Ways Ministry, which had been actually silenced by the Vatican under the previous popes. And now what you have is this group that was, you know, essentially excommunicated, is now sitting down with the bishops to talk about homosexuality and how the church responds to it. Another little noticed facet of that synod on the family that Pope Francis held was that the measures that expressed a warmer welcome to gay and lesbian Catholics, they failed, but they actually passed by a majority. So they mm-hmm. failed to get the two-thirds vote that was required, but a majority of Catholic bishops meeting in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome voted to express more openness towards gay and lesbian Catholics. Again, you know, nothing that you ever would have thought you would have seen.
Right.
So, you know, across the board, really big shifts, and among evangelicals, trying to adopt a softer tone on homosexuality. Had a leading Southern Baptist come out towards the end of the year and say that ex-gay therapy, you know, pray away the gay, is counterproductive and harmful. Again, mm-hmm. one of those headlines you never thought you'd see before.
I personally thought a new thing was the use of the word refrocked, but I guess that doesn't make it into your list. Kevin, do you find that we might be getting a better handle overall on the impact religion is having on our society and world, both positively and negatively? It seems like there are more news reports overall that now include the religious component in their coverage than in previous years. Am I just imagining that, or do you see that?
Well, no, I think you do. And what you see, I think what you saw in 2014 was sort of sometimes religion can play a background role in a lot of these big stories, but they were really brought out to the fore in 2014. So in the ISIS, the rise of the Islamic State, you saw, you know, questions about what is Islam and what is it not. In the Ebola crisis, you know, that devastated West Africa, you know, the people who were actually on the front lines of this were medical missionaries from the United States. Mm-hmm. The people who were brought back to the U.S. for treatment were American missionaries. You know, discussions about race, you know, with Ferguson and the case on Staten Island, you know, where these, you had black men getting killed by white cops, and then the cops got off. A lot of the discussions about race in America and injustice were, you know, led by the churches. Now, I think the churches are playing a different role than they once did in the civil rights movement. It's more of a background role. But you had a really interesting kind of soul-searching among white churches, particularly in the wake of Ferguson, about, you know, what is it about the system that is broken and what is our role in that. And you saw a lot of prominent white Christian pastors come out and say, you know what, something's really screwed up here, mm-hmm. and we've got to learn how to talk to each other. And white people especially have to learn how to understand the problems that black people face every day. So, yeah, you saw the religious, moral, and ethical element to a lot of the big stories really jump out of the front pages this year.
Kevin, what would you consider among the most underreported religion news stories of the year?
So, let's see. You know, one of my favorite stories, it did get some attention, but you really have to kind of connect the dots on it to really sort of see what's going on here and understand that it's a much larger story than maybe it got attention for. The Mormon Church actually did a number of really interesting things this year, kind of quietly. They did it online. It wasn't terribly glitzy or sexy, but they issued a series of statements trying to correct the record as to what Mormons teach or actually believe. So they tackled, you know, these sort of bizarre topics that a lot of people associate with Mormonism, like this question, do Mormons get their own planet when they die? And the church said, well, no, not really. And, you know, do Mormons wear magical underwear? And the church actually used that term. And the church said no. And then they had a statement about, you know, when Joseph Smith translated Mormon scripture, was he actually reading ancient Egyptian or not? And they said, no, he wasn't. And the most, you know, sort of headline-grabbing was when they came out and they said that, yes, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, had as many as 40 wives, and one of them was 14 years old. And so what you saw there was a kind of fascinating real-time evolution in American religion where this, you know, a major faith tradition is trying to come to terms with what it teaches, what it believes, how it's perceived, and its own history. And they're doing that publicly, and they're sort of throwing open the closet doors and saying, okay, here's who we are. And you don't see that very often. You don't see this kind of public spotlight evolution in teaching. And we saw elements of that this year and connect all the dots, and I think it's a really interesting story that probably could have gotten more attention.
Okay, you know I'm going to ask this question because I've asked it every year. What do you think the most important religion news stories of 2015 are likely to be?
That's a good question. All right, I think a couple things to watch. Immigration and the delicate dance that Republicans have to do on this, not only with Hispanics, that gets the most attention, but also with the Catholic bishops who support immigration reform, a lot of evangelicals who support immigration reform. There's a really interesting case, two cases coming out of the Supreme Court worth watching. One is about a case that the justices heard at the end of 2014, but they'll be decided in 2015. And it's about the right of prisoners to grow beards, but it's really about the rights of the state to control religious expression, particularly for prisoners. And another case that the justices are going to be arguing in 2015 is a case involving a young Muslim woman who applied to work at Abercrombie & Fitch, and when she showed up in a hijab, she was told that she couldn't have the job. And so the justices will be hearing and ruling on that in 2015, but it's not just about Muslims, but it's about religious expression in the public sphere, particularly in the commercial sphere, and it's about Jewish men being able to wear skull caps and Christians being able to wear, you know, crosses around their neck, maybe, and it's about accommodation for religion. You know, should Seventh-day Adventists, for example, be able to get Saturday off because that's when they go to church? So it's focused on this case of a young Muslim woman, but there's implications for a whole number of other faiths.
Well, Kevin Ekstrom, you've done it again. Kevin is editor-in-chief of the award-winning Religion News Service, offering world-class non-denominational coverage of religion from around the globe. I hate to admit it because people will probably pity my life, but this is one of the fun moments of the end of the year to sit down with you and go over these stories, and you do it with such excellence. Thanks, as always, for being with us, Kevin, on State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be with you, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, man. Take care.
As Wilton Gaddy retires after 16 years at the helm of Interfaith Alliance, it seemed unforgivable not to take some time on the show to ask him to look back at that long tenure and to reflect on the critical mission that the organization continues to have. So, Weldon, thanks for agreeing to do this.
I'm glad to do it.
Would you describe briefly the genesis of Interfaith Alliance itself? Why was it founded, and what were the goals at the beginning?
Interfaith Alliance started in the minds of a few religious leaders who were really tired of hearing about the Christian right and about the Christian leadership in Washington and the need for a Christian takeover of Washington. Newt Gingrich was leading the Congress. That was a time when the contract with America was being peddled in Congress. The Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell leadership was very pervasive and strong. And these people reached the conclusion, we have to tell leaders and followers in this nation that you don't have to believe like those people believe. You don't have to share their politics in order to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of Christians in this nation who are very opposed to what the so-called religious right is doing, and they sure do not share the vision of America that is so theocratically oriented as you hear in the Falwells and Robertsons of the world.
So how did your involvement begin? And I guess there's no way to answer that question without including at least a little bit about your own history in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Well, yes. I was in the Southern Baptist Convention in one of the higher levels of leadership. I had been in the convention for a long time, and after doing my PhD work in ethics, I went to the Social Ethics Agency in the Southern Baptist Convention that was known as the Christian Life Commission. It was a very progressive, forward-looking social ethics agency. I was the first person on the staff of that agency to look at the development of citizenship and the responsibilities of a Christian in the political arena. At that time, Ray, as hard as it is to imagine, the mantra was, and I'm sorry for Southern Baptists, that they wouldn't want me to use mantra, but was to say politics and religion don't mix, and politicians we ought to stay away from. Jerry Falwell had denounced any kind of political involvement in his church in Virginia. And so that was the background. As
what year was that, Wilton, like roughly?
It was in the late 1970s. And so when in the – about 1978, 79 is when all of that began to change. I remember the first television debate I ever did with Jerry Falwell. I reminded him that I'd been a Baptist a lot longer than he had and that he only came on when his politics seemed to be winning the day in the Southern Baptist life. So there were some people who remembered what I had done in that position. And when the Interfaith Alliance was formed, they eventually recommended me as one of the potential leaders in that movement. I have to say, it's always been a struggle because people simply do not understand how a religious leader could oppose the religiofication of the nation. And so many times I've been told, you ought to be on the other side of this. You ought to be where the Christian right is because it looks like as a Christian you'd want Christians to run this nation. I would settle for Christians running the church, but certainly not the nation. And so the mission of the Interfaith Alliance early on was very narrow. It was focused on countering the religious right and giving a solid message to the nation that you don't have to be like that to be a religious person. In fact, that we believe religion's healthier when it's not doing the kind of work that the religious right's doing. Eventually, that changed. One of the things I said to the search committee that came to me was, I don't get up in the morning to oppose something. I get up to forward something, to lead something. And so we embraced a mission of the protection of religious freedom in this nation, which is the really the foundation for religious pluralism in this nation and for understanding the proper relationship between religion and government. And the pledge was, look, we recognize the right of the religious right to exist. And as long as they don't try to push their message down our throats or down your throats, okay, that's an honest debate we can have in this democracy. But we will criticize them and we will oppose them and we will seek to defeat them when they try to take one religion and make that the state religion in contradiction to the Constitution.
That's a big mission, and clearly it's not quite done.
No, we're not quite there yet.
Real quick before you take a break, why did you decide to keep your pastoral ministry in Louisiana while leading a Washington, D.C. advocacy group?
Well, honestly, the reasons for that have broadened across the years. Early on, it was simply a matter of I love being a pastor of a congregation. And I should even be more specific. I love being pastor of that particular congregation because it is one that was trying to live out a progressive mission and this may surprise you, that Northeast Louisiana is not a hotbed of liberalism. And so they wanted someone who could lead them in what they were wanting to do. And the second reason was the more I knew Washington, the more I understood that many of the people who sound like the greatest religious voices in the government don't know flip about a congregation and what all of this means on the ground. And so I found out that I had greater credibility with members of Congress, with the media in particular, because I happen to know what it's like to be in a congregation in a part of the world that is very conservative in nature. And I think the board and the members of the church have agreed as the years have gone by that it has worked well both ways. I think the church is a local church with a national vision and message, and I think the Interfaith Alliance has benefited from someone who really understands what a local congregation is about and how decisions made at the national level can impact, and if the wrong decisions are made, can actually compromise the ministry of local congregations across the nation.
And on top of that, we can all thank you for helping to keep the airline industry afloat for all these years.
Yes.
I've done
well with frequent flyer miles.
Welton, can you identify a couple of high points from your 16 years as president of Interfaith Alliance?
You know, there are lots of memories that would vie for the high points. Early on in when we were dealing so much with the religious right, we were disturbed by the scorecards that were distributed in churches prior to every election day that were written to provide Christians the people they should vote for and the issues on which they should vote. We worked very hard against that. We sent letters to churches that were vulnerable to that to warn them that that was both not legal or proper for them to do. And the New York Times credited us as being one of the major reasons that that practice came to a halt eventually among the religious right. I think of the signing of the hate crimes bill as one of the high points. We had worked on that bill for 11 or 12 years in a row, going to Capitol Hill every year, working alongside Judy Shepard and others to try to get meaningful change there. It took a long time, but the day that I stood 3 feet from President Obama and watched him announce the signing of that bill, that was one of the times that I'll never forget. I went back to the office and said to the staff that day, I said, look, it took us 11, 12 years to get to this moment. But when you get there and see what it will mean for law enforcement officers and for checking hate crimes, it was worth every minute. Don't ever give up on a piece like that. Those are big memories. But I have some really small events that are, to me, valued moments. I remember getting a call from a radio station in New Jersey, and the man on the other end of the line I'd never met, he said, I'm calling you because last night we had a terrible incident of burning a synagogue in our town. Our town is very broken up over this. Someone told us that we could call you and you would know what to say to us. That was a challenging, chilling moment. I remember also standing on the streets in Miami with in front of me about 20 young people who were gays and lesbians. When I was introduced as a minister, I saw fear in their eyes. When I talked with them about the compassion that we have for them and our efforts to try and see that they were treated equally with their other friends, I saw a softening in their faces and a sense of emotion that was so profound, I'll never forget it. It's both personal and national. Some of it's legislative, some of it's moral, but it takes all of that.
Is there a particular frustration that has dogged you during your tenure, something you wish you could have seen happen?
Sure. I mean, there are pieces of legislation that I wish would happen. ENDA has equal non-discrimination employment bill has lingered way too long without being passed as into a bill. I am frustrated by the fact that Congress itself is now practicing partisan politics more than patriotic politics, that there are people in Congress who vote the party line even when it contradicts their personal feelings. I think that is a tragic way to spend time in Congress. I would always respect a member of Congress who voted his or her opinion over the opinion of the majority leader of either party. And even if they disagreed with me, I would have more respect for them if they voted their conscience rather than voted their party. And I also have to say that I am frustrated because nonprofit organizations are not getting the kind of money they need to do their work. And presidential election years and the year before them, the primaries, always are very, very difficult times for nonprofit organizations like Interfaith Alliance and others. And people forget that it takes the nonprofit organizations to see to it that important legislation gets argued in the proper way, considered, and lets these organizations are the ones that help turn out public support that shapes the ultimate decision on a bill. These organizations deserve financial security and support They're not getting it, and I hope that changes.
Welton, it's a question that you posed to many of your guests on State of Belief, so I want to pose it to you. What have your years leading Interfaith Alliance done to you? How has this experience changed you?
I think I am much more understanding of people who are different from me and different in religion. I have come to love and appreciate people in all different religions and consider them my brothers and sisters. It has made me more informed that the people who lead our government are individuals with all of the same frailties and blind spots that any of the other of us have. And I'll tell you something that has been in my mind every day that I have been in this job. One of the great benefits of it was becoming a friend of Walter Cronkite, one of the really greatest men I've ever known. The first day on the job, my responsibility was to be with Mr. Cronkite for an event. And Walter took me aside that night, and he said, "I want you to understand what's at stake in the work you've come to do. Nothing less is at stake in the mission of the Interfaith Alliance than democracy as we've known it. I've come to love democracy and to understand just how fragile it is, even in our country."
The Reverend Dr. C. Welton Gaddy has just retired as president of Interfaith Alliance, a position he held for 16 years. His voice is one that we need to continue to hear on matters of religion, ethics, the Constitution, and the promise of this great country. The author of over 20 books, Welton is the pastor for preaching and worship at Northminster Church in Monroe, Louisiana. Welton Gaddy has been the host of State of Belief Radio since its founding in 2006. In just 2 weeks, we'll be marking 8 years of broadcasting from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. And so to wrap up this week's show, I think it's only fair to pull a couple of minutes from that first broadcast featuring the late Walter Cronkite. This sums up the work that Welton and Interfaith Alliance have done together, as well as the work that lies ahead for all of us dedicated to protecting faith and freedom.
In his nearly 20 years as anchor of the CBS Evening News, he earned the title of the most trusted man in America. He joins us today to discuss religion in America and in the media and his work with the Interfaith Alliance. It's my great pleasure to welcome Walter Cronkite. Walter, I can think of no other person that I would rather have as the first guest on this show. Thanks so much for being here.
I'm delighted to be invited.
Walter, you have, through the years, vigorously protected the objectivity of your reporting, carefully telling a story and not injecting personal opinions into it. But in recent years, you've decided to voice your opinions, especially about the religious right and what's happening in the fusion between religion and politics in this nation. What brought about that change? What made you decide to speak out?
During my long years as the anchor man of CBS Evening News, I was obligated to respect only the facts and not opinion. Hearing to that, I felt myself handicapped in speaking out about what I thought about what was going on in the activities of the far right.
Over the past decade or more, you've been a really grand supporter of the Interfaith Alliance, and of course a part of our work focuses on countering the religious right. I've often wondered, would you ever have imagined in prior years that this kind of agency and mission would claim so much of your attention?
No, I don't think I would have, although certainly my feelings about the place of religion in our lives and in our politics, indeed, in our daily lives, was not something that came to me late in life. I've thought about that for a great deal from many years ago when I was an altar boy in a newly found church, a Unitarian church in Houston, Texas, that my father organized.
I saw a USA Today poll that was taken on December the 18th that showed that 49% of American adults say they believe most members of Congress are corrupt, And the numbers remain below 50%, changing very little when people were asked specifically about trust for Democrats or trust for Republicans. That kind of lack of confidence in our leaders does not bode well, of course, for a participatory democracy. So let me ask you this. As the most trusted man in America, what counsel would you give to members of Congress on how to regain people's trust?
Well, the answer is simple, quite simple. Actually, achieving it is not as simple. And that is, tell people the truth. This is fundamental. Obviously, many politicians, as those in business and law or anywhere else, are likely to shade the truth. It's not new in our lives, not new in our government. It's been a feature of government as long as I think we've had one. But that does not relieve us of the responsibility to say, now we ought to try to straighten this thing out. We've been living it for 200 years and getting by with it. But why just get by? Why not try to improve the system? And I would insist on that you can only improve the system with honesty.
In an earlier segment on today's program, I spoke about how I think religious pluralism in this land is in danger. You recently expressed concerns focused on an even more basic danger. There have been several occasions recently where you have said you think democracy is in great peril. Why do you say that?
In making that statement I'm tying it to the state of our education in the country. I base everything I say from here on out on Thomas Jefferson's once statement that I sort of live by, and that is that a nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never can be. If we cannot teach our children properly to bring them into an intelligent adult age, we are endangering our very existence as a democracy.
Is there any event in recent days that alarmed you, that caused you to be angry, that made the light come on for you to make those kinds of statements?
There has been a general trend that has bothered me. The fact that religion has been brought so much to the fore of our political discussion these days bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it belongs there. The case for a political movement or idea or individual is quite important to our democracy, quite clearly. I think it is, well, if we can look toward them and say, well, they are faithful to their faith, but they are not trying to force their faith upon me as a fellow member of their democracy. And that is most important in my considerations.
I imagine most of us could cite sources that we think are part of the problem. I would, for example, talk about the lack of civics and education in politics and government. But I have to ask you, because you know more about this than anybody else, do the media have to take any responsibility here? And let me expand that. If a person is watching national news programs, the evening news and cable news and all of that, are they getting a good education in democracy?
Well, that's such a broad question.
I'll get in trouble if it's more specific.
Yes, I think you're already in trouble with that question.
Walter, just one general question. Looking back over your extraordinary career, which started covering World War II, is there one thing you're most proud of or that you feel most fulfilled by in your career?
Good gracious. I think of all those things that I've been pleased to have a part in reporting. There have been so many important stories in these years. Undoubtedly, the most important of them, to my mind, was the fact that man achieved the and seemingly impossible and walked on the moon. This would be the leading story of our time for 500 years, even as Columbus's landing is still the date that school children learn today. I am reasonably satisfied now that I have practically retired, although I don't want anybody to think that would like to hire me for a speech. But I have retired from active daily journalism. And as such, I can look back on a lot of stories that I think we did very well, that were not necessarily my successes, but were the successes of our team of news producers. We had some very fine ones. I was pretty proud, particularly, that I took a public role about the Vietnam War at one point, a very unusual situation with CBS of a reporter being able to state a personal opinion. But there I thought it was so important to say that we really had done our best in Vietnam, but now was time for us to get out. And I think I had some influence in that particular case. It might be that under the present circumstances in the Middle East, there might be somebody who'll stand up and say that there.
Walter, for many of us, your voice accompanied all of the events that you've talked about, and you led us through them. You have been in this nation a model of truth-telling, of patriotism, of journalism, and a really good friend. Thank you.
Well, that's too much, but thank you.
That's the late Walter Cronkite speaking to Welton Gaddy on the first ever State of Belief program, broadcast January 15th, 2006. Happy New Year, Welton, and thank you for the years you've given to a cause so many of us believe deeply in. And because State of Belief isn't going anywhere, I'll go back into the control room and I'll let you wrap up the show the way you've always done.
Thank you very much. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this past week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today as you consider your end-of-the-year giving plans. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And share the stories that you find compelling. Share them with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what?